Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are off down the canal again having one of our long walks, and today we want to talk about sex, the juicy subject of sex. This is one of the episodes in our series about the body. So I was going to start off by saying how strangely, even though sexual experience is a normal, I dare use that word, they are normal, and a commonality between all humans that aren't asexual, it still is very strange. You know, when you actually stop and think about it and really think, well, what's going on here?
You're trying to explain it to Martians if they kind of split like amoebas or something like that, you know. They'd look at it and say, you what?
I find it very...
Seriously?
I find it very odd that my body wants to do these strange things. And just in case anyone's imaginations are really running away with them there, not that strange, okay? not that strange, but in a way, like, it just feels strange. Like your body just wants to just... Yeah, you know what I mean. And it can pop up at such odd times. It could be...
Especially if you're a teenage boy.
Yeah, especially if you're a teenage boy.
And probably a teenage girl as well. In some ways, they're kind of, I don't know. Anyway, we won't go there.
Apart from just musing on the weirdness of it all, I have many other interesting things to say. We were walking around the park yesterday and had a long, what we call a pre-talk, about all the things that we wanted to mention.
Yes, indeed. Well, you're right. It's... this topic definitely belongs in our series on the body.
Yes, definitely. We can't skip over sex if we're doing a series about the body, that's for sure.
No. And we can't skip over the body if you're trying to think about sex either. So, and I agree, you know, there's something profoundly mysterious, potentially at least, about sexual desire, sexual arousal, the actual sex acts themselves. And there's a sense in which, through our sexuality, we can be, at least potentially, be brought face to face with our mystery, you know, and the mystery of existence and the mystery of human existence, the bottomless mystery of it.
Yeah, it does have a certain psychedelic quality, as
it can do, and yeah, I mean, we should here perhaps quickly dispose of the way in which sex is actually used in human society, you know, because it can be used to punish, you know, or for instance, like the rape is used as an instrument of war.
Yeah.
You know, so when you're talking about sex, it's not just this nice thing that's associated with it, but a lot of nefarious, dark stuff.
Yeah.
You know, sex also includes crimes of sexual violence, sexual violence in war, prostitution, slavery, and of course the whole thing is entangled with patriarchy. You know, the oppression of women by men in most societies. Etc. etc. So there's a lot of considerations that we could give around this dark side. But at this point, I just want to remind ourselves, you know, that that kind of wondrous stuff is not the whole story.
Yeah.
Just so that, you know, I'm saying that so people aren't going to sort of offer up a criticism. These guys have got rose-coloured spectacles on, you know. So, yeah. Anyway, that just needs to be mentioned, I think.
Yeah. And just before we get to the meat of the biology culture argument, which we're going to jump into in a minute, I'd just like to mention a film that is available on Netflix called Hysteria.
Oh yeah.
Which you won't believe could possibly be true, and I still can't believe it's true, but in the 19th century, many women were diagnosed with hysteria, right? Yeah. And one of the treatments for this was to go to the doctor and be wanked off by the doctor. Actually, having an orgasm for a woman was a medical procedure.
Yeah.
And this is actually how the vibrator was developed. But honest to God, it's not like a fantastic film, but you just won't believe that this is actually true.
All this stuff's documented, you know. And what do they call it? Hysterical paroxysm.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just gobsmacking.
I don't think working class women
couldn't afford it. It was quite expensive.
We're paying the, I don't know, 5 guineas.
Because the doctors ended up getting RSI, didn't they? Because of all the wanking they had to do.
They did, yeah. Poor devils.
Anyway, that's...
I suppose it was probably kind of quite exciting and novel the first few times, but after a bit it'd be like, you know, being a bus conductor or something.
Well, for the doctor, yeah. Another one, yeah. Yeah.
The world is a very strange place, isn't it?
Very strange. Anyway, onto the discussion that we were having yesterday then, so.
Well, the film you mentioned just really highlights that sex isn't purely biological, it's cultural.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this practice was probably, you know, the done thing amongst the bourgeois women of London in 1890, or certain socio-economic class of women. You know, and it seems kind of a bit outlandish and preposterous now from our perspective in the 21st century.
Yeah.
And it just illustrates the cultural nature of sexual expression, sexual desire, and the actual customs surrounding the sex act itself. These vary enormously across cultures and across historical times.
Yeah.
They really do. Michel Foucault, great French philosopher, wrote a great big fat book, well, in fact a series of books, I think it went to 4 volumes, called The History of Sexuality. I've never managed to read it, you know. one day I will, I hope. I believe it's quite entertaining. But because the title does everything that I need it to do.
Yeah.
Does sexuality have a history? Surely it's just a biological function.
Perhaps not.
Yeah, penis, vagina. The human body, it's a product of evolution, it's a mammalian method of reproduction of the species, it's there to make babies. It's a, you know, the mechanics are fairly straightforward for transferring DNA, you know, for combining DNA.
Yeah.
So how come it has a history? Well, it has a history because we're human beings, we're cultural beings. And in fact, a lot of the discussion around sexuality falls down, well, popular discussion, I think philosophers get a bit more nuanced, but you know, your basic run-of-the-mill discourse that you might find in TV Times or Cosmopolitan or something, or Playboy, whatever, kind of runs along the tram lines of a nature-culture dichotomy. But again, another binary. We find ourselves, we keep talking about binaries, and we're always wanting to fuzzy them up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, because nature is a useful concept, and culture is a useful concept. But we tend to kind of talk of them as stark opposites. And if we think that way, well, obviously the starting point does a great deal to determine the outcome of the thought and the argument. And I think if we think along these tram lines, nature culture, there's a stark binary that we end up not really deriving anything very useful to ourselves. It's something that's a bit quite misleading about what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, we could write a book on that, you know, it's just on that. You know, it's a massive topic, so condensing it down a bit, which I think we need to do here, is to say, well, if a bird builds a nest, you know, the nest is an artifact of the bird, but it's still natural. The bird's natural, and it's natural for the bird to do it.
Yeah.
It all comes in this all-enclosing sphere of nature. What if you like, you know, just the biosphere, if we're going to just narrow it down a little bit and keep it on the earth, you know, the biosphere. Similarly, human beings, but our cultures, the cultures that we build and all the artifacts that are part and parcel of the culture, like the cities and the roads and the machines and the internet, all this stuff, contraception, surgery, medicine, all of this stuff is natural. In the same way that a bird's nest is natural.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, Homo faber.
It's one way of
looking
do.
One way of looking at the human being is the animal which fabricates, it makes things.
Yeah.
Makes things. Actual things, you know. I keep going on about the canal. Canal's a great symbol, you know, that some blokes in 1780 dug it out with spades.
Yeah.
It's an artifact, you know.
Yeah.
Homo faber captures a big aspect of the human being. But also we make imaginative structures like religions and grand narratives which we use to help us to navigate life, find our way around as mapping systems or as ways of imposing social order.
Yeah.
Through shared belief, etc. Now sex is right the way in there with that. And the film Hysteria, you know, just amply illustrates that. But yeah, there is a biological base. I mean, there's an urge, rather similar to hunger. Except, of course, if you don't have sex, you won't die. If you don't have food, you will die. So there's a slight difference. But the urge is pretty powerful. As Grampy said, Grampy is the ex-hippie father of Della, the mother of an illustrious band of feral children.
In the TV series on Channel 4 called Raised by Wolves, which is set in Wolverhampton, is probably one of the funniest things you'll ever see.
If you understand the sense of humour, of course. But anyway, there's this character, Grampy, who lives in the cubbyhole under the stairs.
Yes.
And his granddaughter Yoko is suffering deep angst. She's about 11, I think, or 12 or something.
Yeah, she just discovered eyeliner.
Yeah, she just discovered eyeliner. But they homeschooled these kids. They don't go to school. And she sits around reading books on the ecological crisis and the extinction.
Wearing black and getting more depressed.
Yeah, and she's very, very depressed about the extinction of all the species, which means she's actually quite sad. She's called Yoko.
Yeah.
And Yoko asks him about this. He says, well, look, you know, overpopulation, it's terrible. And then she says to him, well, I suppose the solution is vegetarianism, because fewer cow farts, you know.
Yeah, and the land, use of land,
etc.
Yeah.
Vegetarianism and birth control. And Grampy says to her, he says, well, Yoko, he says, mankind is hardwired to sacrifice everything to the prospect of nookie and bacon. And, well, I mean, that just says it all, you know. It's a powerful urge.
Yeah.
Right. And nature, in her wisdom, has definitely hardwired us, you know, to reproduce the species. And if you believe Richard Dawkins, you know, the whole thing is a selfish gene scenario. And we should look upon ourselves as mere containers of genes. It was just, I say, hardwired just simply to contain these genes and to propagate them. You know. So with several billion years of evolution behind it, that urge has got like a lot of power.
Yeah.
And that accounts for its strangeness, you know.
Yeah.
It's that kind of plugging into the deep past, perhaps, you know. I'm not saying that one is aware of that during sexual activity. It's just that is what is playing through in some ways. But as I said, you know, we can't, if we try and think about it solely in terms of nature and biology, we really do kind of lose the plot, you know. Because sexual expression...
It's just overlaid so much with culture.
Yeah, sexual expression and sexual activities is deeply cultural. And as such, you know, it's massively dependent on all the things which mould culture and play their part in its ongoing transformation, its ongoing movement and development. I mean, for instance, as I mentioned earlier, the development of contraception. You know, more and more and more effective contraception has changed things immensely.
Yeah.
And just obviously,
yeah,
less anxiety for women. I mean, I was a young man in the 1960s, you know, and suddenly GPs, perhaps there was a government directive or something, I don't know, or whether they just decided amongst themselves, would give the contraceptive pill to any woman, married or unmarried, simply on the asking, over the age of 16. And let's say there was a sexual revolution, you know, and yeah. I suppose in some ways there was, but this was down to an invention.
Yeah.
You know, but what people don't realise, to reach that point, it's a tremendous struggle in the Western world, certainly. I mean, in the Catholic Church, still outlaws contraception.
Yeah.
Still does. Apart from the rhythm method, so-called, you know. Just trying to track cycles of ovulation and blah blah blah, all that, you know. But certainly, women who campaigned or tried in very practical ways to make contraceptive available, especially to poor women and working class women, who are having their health and their bodies destroyed just by endless pregnancies.
Yeah.
And somebody like Annie Besant, you know, the establishment ruined her life. You know, and there was one of the big campaigners in America whose name escapes me. I mean, they absolutely pilloried the woman. I think she was charged with some kind of offence because she was sending diaphragms through the post, and they got her on a law that said for using the postal service to transmit indecent material.
Ugh, God.
I mean, these women struggled. They had their lives ruined. They went to jail. Annie Besant lost her children, you know.
Yeah.
And because she saw the plight of working class women and said they need contraception.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just, you know, this is how cultural it is. It comes down to political struggle.
Yeah.
And particularly around you know the place of women in patriarchal societies and the struggle against patriarchy.
Yeah.
I mean, some women have thought the solution there is just to have nothing to do with men, or to have nothing to do with sex and so forth.
Yeah. But the cultural aspect, also it's down to like what actually happens in the bedroom between consenting adults, you know, whether they're same sex or
or not,
you know. Well, all of that, when we were talking about it yesterday, and you said something like, whenever a couple have sex, there's at least four people in the room.
Yeah. Well, that is another theme that I want to. It's really important, but it's a bit early to mention that.
Oh, okay, sorry, yeah. I'm jumping the gun there.
You are absolutely jumping the gun there, yeah.
But the cultural thing being just there in the act itself.
Whichever way you look at it, the community or society or the government or the state, whichever happens to be the predominant agent of peer pressure in a particular society, does say that sexuality is its business. Every society tries to regulate sexuality.
Yeah.
Even the so-called primitive societies, which people look to for their closeness to nature, supposedly, have got very strong things to say about the way people express sexuality and what they do and what is permitted, you know?
Yeah.
Whether it's permitted in marriage through a system of marriage and what the system of marriage might be.
Just passing a barge, that's what that noise is.
Yeah. I mean, the system of marriage in the Trobriander Islanders, you know, is documented by Malinowski, famously. And I bring that example out because it drew Freud's attention and then later Wilhelm Reich's attention.
Yeah. What were their ideas?
Well, the thought was that the society was showed a transition that most of humanity must have gone through thousands of years ago, from a polymorphous, perverse society in which you could shag anybody, you know, and teenagers shagged each other just to say that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To a system of bride barter, in which brides became the properties of their fathers. And this is the transition from a matriarchal, or at least an equal society, to a society dominated by men, which women became the properties of their fathers, and they were given a way in marriage to make political alliances. And so you got very elaborate taboo systems about who you could marry and who you couldn't marry. Actually, incest taboos. You couldn't marry your father, your cousin, but you couldn't marry anybody in the same clan as you. And it got very, very complex. But you know, you can see that was a regulation of sexuality. And the Trobriander Islanders seem to be in a hybrid state between shifting away from the polymorphous perverse, because they did let the teenagers pair bond for a short time. Not sure of the intricacies before marriage as a property transaction took place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even to this day, you know, if you're of that ilk and you go to church, you will be given away by your father as though he owns you.
Yeah.
As property.
Yeah.
And of course the royals and the aristocracy still do this kind of fucking eugenics.
Yeah.
And it's pretty horrible really, but there you go.
Yeah.
I'm very 21st century about it all, me, you know. So there's always some kind of social control, except in the most, I mean, even in the polymorphous perverse, you know, I mean, it still is the custom in the societies, you know, where they have the village orgy. I mean, Terence McKenna loved to fantasise about this. So imagine like a matriarchal society in the deep prehistory, in which no father knew who his children were, because all children were conceived at a mushroom-fueled village orgy.
Yeah.
And this is what produced the social bond.
Yeah.
Was the fact that nobody knew who the fathers of the children were. So everybody took responsibility for the children.
Yeah.
And everybody shagged everybody off the face of mushrooms. And this defused all the kind of dominance, male testosterone-fueled dominance games of the men. Which came to the fore when there was climate change and the mushroom died out. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it's incredibly fanciful, but there's probably a little kernel of truth in it, because we know that societies do have remnants of this Dionysian village orgy, which very often produces this sort of bonding, this collective social bonding. And certainly you see it for instance, you know, Tantra, the sexual side of Tantra has its roots in this, you know, it's something that kind of, it lingered on. The Dionysian cults of the Greeks, and the Maenad rituals of the ancient Greeks and the Romans, you know.
Tell us about the Maenads briefly.
And the,
because they are interesting, just as an aside.
Well, I don't really want to go into that, but it was a Dionysian women's cult. Hello. In which there seemed to have been sexual expression amongst women in an orgiastic situation on the top of mountains. I think they kind of worshipped Cybele, who was a sort of a female Dionysus. You know, a god of intoxication and orgy. But these were women-only things, and they'd sidle off up the mountain and do this drumming, dancing, ripping their clothes off, getting stoned and pleasuring each other sexually.
Well, it does kind of rather sound like fun. Anyway, we digress. Carry on.
So I'm saying there is that kind of possibility, and that we have remnants of it. And it, of course, it's kind of archetypal, and it does burst out, you know. It does burst out. it's a kind of side of human life that kind of won't be repressed, I don't think, that,
no,
you know.
Never going to repress that one, no matter how much
religion or church
tries.
But against this tendency, societies, particularly patriarchal societies, always try and regulate sexuality through marriage, through taboos, and so on. I mean, homosexuality was illegal and carried quite draconian punishments up into the 1960s in the UK. Alan Turing, of course, who made the modern world, him and a handful of others, a computer genius, was pilloried by the British state and committed suicide because his sexual proclivity was anonymous sex with men. Recently, like last month, the great state of Michigan passed a bill, a state bill, outlawing anal sex. Now, whatever you think of the pleasures of such a practice, you think, well, between consenting adults, who cares? Why should anybody care? But the great state of Michigan, in the 21st century, passed a law outlawing.
That is bloody astonishing.
What people do in their own bedroom.
Yeah.
So, just, I'm saying all that to underscore the point about control. Sexuality is always controlled by the state, by society, by the powers that be, by the hegemon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just being very crude and broad brush here, it seems to me that sexual expression opens up the possibility of a really raw joy. Absolutely raw joy. You know, Ananda in that kind of, in that yogic sense, you know,
is
the purest, rawest joy, and it is joy just for itself and in itself.
Yeah.
But that is an absolutely emancipatory force, and so every attempt has to be made to stop it. Just people experience joy, raw joy like that, they become fearless, and they become
empowered
and loving towards their fellows.
Yeah.
These are dangerous people.
Yeah.
For a power structure, for a patriarchy. So there is something potentially liberating in sexuality there, you know.
Yeah.
One of the prominent means of controlling sexuality that most societies use is the taboo. I mean, the most familiar ones, the incest taboo.
Yeah.
But these are just, you know, deeply ingrained social injunctions that there are some things you just don't do. Sexually, some things you just don't do sexually. Every society's got them, and maybe it's probably even sort of necessary at some level, you know. I mean, if somebody got their rocks off by every Saturday night going to town, going into the nearest pub and hacking about four people to pieces with a machete, and that is what floated their boat.
Yeah.
And there probably is somebody for whom that would float their boat.
Yeah.
Because your boat can get floated by bloody all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Now we say, well, we don't want to permit that. And it would be right for us not to permit that as a collectivity in the name of individual freedom. You know, so taboo is going to, it's a part of the landscape whichever way we look at it.
So even the, as you said, the most liberal society would still
it has taboo.
Have to control sex in some way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our particular society isn't very keen on paedophilia.
Yeah.
And you know, there's like wall to wall sexualisation of all the media. Yeah. A pretty easygoing attitude to most practices amongst most people, I would say, like in Europe and in the liberal parts of America. Nevertheless, there's this very strong taboo, you know, and it's kind of in the news. Strange it might seem, it wasn't ever thus. I mean, as you know, the Greeks, you know, the ancient Greeks, the Athenians, I mean, their thing, the highest form of sexual expression was between an old man and a youth. Kind of just about pubescent youth, and the man acted the part of the guru to the youth and is his life mentor, but they also had a sexual relationship,
and was like completely accepted and the norm, and it was actually seen as a good, wasn't it?
It was seen as a good, And similarly, I mean, I know some yoga people are going to be offended by this, but according to Alan Danielu, the ancient yogis were practicing paedophiles.
Right.
So, I'm not trying to put a rubber stamp on any of this stuff, but I am trying to indicate that even the taboos, are quite variable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's still parts of the world now where they marry 8-year-old girls after kind of 50-year-old blokes. I do. So, taboos, you kind of... I think the only universal one is probably the incest taboo. Otherwise, they're kind of up for grabs. But in having a taboo and enforcing it, a society exerts its control and its right to control sexuality, and therefore to control the possibility of joy. I mean, I think this is only dimly and semi-consciously understood, but it is there in the equation. I suppose what's happening in our modern times is the state, say in Western Europe, is discovering, slowly but surely, that they can loosen the bonds over sexuality without and use it and exploit it, rather than it resulting in complete social collapse. Actually, everything hasn't collapsed. Society didn't collapse because we legalised homosexuality. If you'd listened to Mary Whitehouse, she'd have said the whole of Western civilisation would fall into the sea if you let blokes do what they want to do to each other, homosexual men, you know. So, now the interesting thing about transgression and taboo, well, a taboo can be transgressed, can't it?
So what is transgression?
It's when it's breaking the rules.
Right.
Breaking the rules, breaking a taboo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Georges Bataille is a very interesting writer on this subject, if turgid in his style.
Hello.
All right.
Hello.
If turgid in his style, nevertheless, makes this point, this big point, that eroticism, you know, the actual pursuit of an erotic turn-on, is intimately entangled with the transgression of taboos. You know, and I pondered this and thought, well, that's a bit funny. And actually, he's right. He's right, you know. And I think most people can find that inside themselves. You know, forbidden fruit is the term we use, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, to forbidden fruit is beguiling, attractive. The arousal is more intense.
Yeah, and a lot of the, romance fiction is all about that.
It is these days, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
50 Shades of Grey. I mean, it's all a little bit kind of not quite respectable.
Yeah, but all kind of...
And that is the turn-on.
The vampire human cross-species romance stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's such a turn-on to them because they're not supposed to be doing it.
Yeah.
Every teenager understands this. So, again, you can see that, you know, the notion, oh, sex is really is natural. How it's kind of knocked on the head by this little kind of bit of anthropology. I mean, the sex is natural thing is something that's probably pushed, you know, by the romantics, perhaps. I certainly D.H. Lawrence, who is pretty well suffused with romanticism, writing in the first part of the 20th century. That was a view that he held, you know, and in Lady Chatterley's Lover, there's this naturalness which overcomes the artificiality of class distinction and the artificiality of refined manners, you know. And it's the gamekeeper who's the epitome of wholesome sexuality because he's close to nature.
Yeah.
You know, so you can see how that works. There's somewhat in it, but of course the gamekeeper himself was cultural. You know, working class men's sexual culture was what he was bringing to bear on the situation, but Lawrence wanted to represent it as something else. So transgression, yeah, we've got to keep that in the picture, you know, and how that works. And obviously it only works as a turn-on or as an ingredient in us in sexual arousal, sexual desire, because of taboos, which in turn attempts by society to control sexuality. Now, I mentioned the orgiastic tendencies in ancient civilizations, the Dionysiac, the Shaivite, the Tantric. These are actually all of a piece. And they also work with transgression to some extent. And the logic is that if one is to be liberated, spiritually liberated, inverted commas, whatever that is, but if one is to be liberated, one shouldn't be in thrall of man-made rules and social customs.
Yeah.
So you get in Tantra, for instance, particularly in like left-hand Tantra, Vamamarga, left-handed Tantra, you get what we call antinomianism.
Yeah.
And antinomianism is a willful breaking of the rules and the taboos and the things which are generally agreed to be discussed in order to demonstrate to oneself and the world that one has overcome such petty restrictions and one is therefore free. So, the Gaudi Sadhus, for instance, who live, or who used to live, if there are any of these about now, there's very few, but it is a phenomenon of these guys who would live on a burning ground, and if they got a chance to eat some human flesh, they would. To show that
the burning ground being where they would burn the corpses of
cremate the bodies, yeah. You know, and these guys will eat shit to prove that they're beyond it, you know.
Well, hell.
Now, I think it's a bit silly. I think antinomianism's is still parasitic upon the taboos that it claims it's breaking. You know, and also that kind of antinomianism misses the ordinary, misses the power and the beauty of the ordinary. It has a kind of a bit of a not quite straight relationship with that in its move to the extremity. So antinomianism, I think, is a tendency that comes out of this, out of the situation vis-a-vis sex, you know. And so, in left-hand Tantra, it's thought sexual arousal, sexual activity, excitement, sexual excitement, and depending on who you ask, orgasm, are all doorways into the yoga being state, kind of call it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the enlightened and vast consciousness.
Which one could describe as being vibrantly awake?
Yes.
Maybe?
That's quite good. I like that. That's quite good. That's good. So,
vividly awake.
Yeah. In the interest of that, they'll play kind of spin the bottle in a ritual, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got to shag somebody you don't know, possibly, because if it's anonymous, none of the complications get in the way, the pure arousal, the arousal without any baggage. So there's an anonymity. But also there's the antinomian thing in these ceremonies of Panchamakara, the five M's, which is breaking the five taboos deliberately and ritualistically of the, you know, the host, respectable host and quite puritanical society. So you eat meat, mamsa, you know, because the spiritual thing to do is to be a vegetarian, so you eat meat.
Yeah.
You eat fish, matsya, same thing, same argument.
Yeah.
You practice sex outside marriage,
yeah.
Maithuna, sexual intercourse, generally frowned upon, generally even in marriage thought to be kind of dirty or fallen or to do with base matter and the horrible bag of shit known as the body. You know, we've talked about this endlessly.
Yeah.
So that is transgressed,
yeah.
Deliberately with Maithuna. There's madja, wine. You're supposed to drink if you're a good pious person, you don't drink, so they drink.
Yeah.
Magic wine. And mudra, which translates, as you translate, it's parched grain. We think mudra was a drug.
Oh.
It might have been something like a soma type drug, you know, like a kind of a brew, a tea. In latter times, we know people would use bang lassi, like cannabis.
Yeah.
You know, oral cannabis, which can be quite kind of trippy. But a drug, a psychedelic drug. So all of these rules are broken. Of course, you know, good, clean, puritanical yogis, no drugs, no wine, no meat, no fish, no sex. Swami Vivekananda. Says all this. I mean, he's so down on the body and on sexual expression. But he says, you know, if you have sex and practice yoga, you'll go mad. Don't do it. Don't do it. You know.
Sex is, sex I think we're screwed then.
I mean, the other idea that you get there is that, somehow sexual energy, if it's kind of squirted into a sock, or whatever you might say, is energy that you might otherwise have used to give power to your meditation, give force to your meditation. You know, that you had to sublimate all this stuff. And it's kind of bollocks, you know. And at least the tantrics recognise, in amongst the confusion of antinomianism, that that all aspects of life are kind of opportunities for enlightenment.
Yeah.
But theoretically, every moment of life is an opportunity for enlightenment. Practically and realistically, certain intense experiences bring it more to the fore for us as real human beings. And of course, you know, sex, as we've said, is very impressive.
Yeah.
Very, very impressive. It's primordial. It's right there at the roots of life.
Yeah.
Because it's to do with the reproduction of life.
Yeah. So that intensity of that experience really embeds itself in you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
And it can change you an awful lot.
Yeah, and it's, they're right about that. And what is great about that approach is that it doesn't denigrate anything. You know, it's all phenomena of pure. There's no life negation in there. It's happy about that side of life, and it's even celebratory of it, and it's even willing to raise it up to the highest thing, you know. And they've got all kinds of theoretical reasons why, you know, for instance, you know, the human couple in Maithuna actually emulates the cosmic drama of Shiva and Shakti coming back into oneness, and out of that oneness giving birth to the whole of existence, you know, and that the ultimate reality is this marriage of the opposites, of you know, of the god and the goddess, of the lingam and the yoni, you know, which is a kind of, I suppose, for me personally, why I'm always attempting to fuzzy the boundaries between all the stark binaries that we find ourselves using, just simply because we think.
Yeah.
And the tantrics have kind of got all that kind of very clear, very, very clear. And the Dionysiacs, and you know, the Celtic Dionysiacs, wherever there's Dionysianism, and an understanding of the relative nature of the taboos of a particular society, that there is a fantastic opportunity for us. Now, I'd be taking a slightly different tack here. You know, I'm appreciative of this stuff, you know, but I'd take a slightly different tack, and I would draw attention to the different modes of consciousness that sexual excitement, sexual expression can give rise to. Now, what I'm going to suggest is by no means exhaustive, but it's these are things that jump out at me that I think are kind of useful and tell us something. And and again, I think Tantra is alert to this, you know. If you read some of the tantric texts, you see that they're alert to what I'm about to say. Just like psychedelics, you know, the sexual afflatus, can I call it, sexual arousal.
Yeah.
Can take us in at least two kind of quite different directions.
Yeah.
The first one, I'm sure everybody's familiar with this, and you mentioned it earlier on, is fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, the fantasy aspects of the brain, its ability to imagine scenarios quite vividly, it can be very, very greatly intensified by sexual arousal and sexual contact and intercourse and just any kind of sexual behaviour, you know. And as you said, you know, in every married couple's bedroom, there's at least four people.
Or any consenting couple.
Or any consenting couple. Yeah. You know, because fantasy kicks in as just simply as a result of the arousal. You know, so. And sexual arousal seems to be able to do this like very vividly and very strongly. Of course, people can imagine without it, but it does have this power, you know. On the one hand. On the other hand, it can throw the imagination from hyper to hypo, you know, from massively intense, souped up, intensified to bracketed out almost, you know, into a kind of mode of consciousness which, very crudely speaking, you might just say it's just pure sensation.
Yeah.
And in that one is aware of all the energetics of the situation, and it may stimulate the imagination in the sense of photic phenomena and envisaging the whole thing as kind of lines of force and light and
yeah.
all those sort of phenomena.
But I've definitely had that.
But it's quite abstract.
Yeah.
Quite abstract. It's not. I don't know, some third party who you'd like to fuck or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's just completely different scenario. It's this.
Yeah.
It's this. Pure is the wrong word, and sensation is quite the wrong word. But it's almost like the imagination, the pictorial imagination, the worldly imagination seems to be attenuated, and. I mean, there's nothing wrong with fantasy. There's nothing wrong with anything. I'm a tantric, you know. There's nothing wrong with anything at bottom. But that kind of mode of immediacy or of reduced fantasy, from my way of looking at stuff, really is a very, very prominent opening for us as human beings, you know. It's an opportunity. As I said, technically, every moment's an opportunity, but in reality, we need the intensity to find it, at least until we kind of get very established in the whole game, in which case, you know, it's everywhere, whether you like it or not.
When you're
established in it, you can't escape it, whatever you try and do. When you're not, it eludes you at every turn.
Yeah.
And you need the intensity.
Yeah.
It's the intense moments of life that throw it at us. You know?
Yeah, that opens the door.
And I think that... when sexual arousal throws you into that mode, that you know, the Vigyan Bhairava Tantra, that thing that it says, well, Shiva's reality reveals itself in the moments of in the arousal. I mean, from their point of view, they like the build up, you know, the build up and try and prolong that. Therefore,
as many of us do.
Yeah. So. You know, so the arousal, the plateau is extended, as Masters and Johnson's terminology, the plateau is extended.
Yeah.
Others claim that it's the orgasm. I mean, Ajit Mukherjee, for instance, I remember seeing him speak in London in the 1970s, and he was talking about Kundalini, and he said, when there's an orgasm, Kundalini is struck, it stirs momentarily. So you have a kind of a sense of that from the sense of orgasm. You know, so... it depends who you ask.
Yeah.
And maybe, I think everything to do with sex is horses for courses or different strokes for different folks anyway.
Yeah.
You know. But I would want to identify that at least those two modes of consciousness that are very easily switched on through sexuality, you know. So, it's good gear, isn't it?
Okay.
So, I don't know, summarising here a little bit, you know, I'm saying there is this massive potential, and I see more in the hypo fantasy rather than the hyper fantasy. I see it as more present in the immediacy of the sensations of the stark and vivid awareness of the energy of the situation. I don't mean the energy of you, I mean the energy of you and your partner and or partners and the interaction between them, that in that totality, that total system, that awareness, direct immediate awareness of the sensation and energy of that system, which is you and the other. You know, that is the unity. The unity is between self and other. You know, that is where I'm suggesting, dear listeners, that you kind of take a look. It strikes me as a gilded and highly ornamented gateway, which is wide open.
Yeah.
But I would want to say, even further there, you know, that the whole world is erotic when one sort of takes a step through that door. The whole world is erotic. All experience is erotic. Trees are a turn on. Water's a turn on. Yeah. Sky's a turn on. Crowds are a turn on. You know, and actually a turn on, you know, in that kind of energetic, quivering, excited, sexual way, you know. The world is libidinal. Human existence is erotic. It is sexual. And I say vis-a-vis the other, just the other in general is a fantastic opportunity again. And, you know, meet the other in openness. Whatever sex they are, whatever orientation they are, meet them in openness, and that everything will transpire from that. But that actually is a sexual moment, in a very broad, you know, it's an erotic moment, it's a libidinal moment, because the world is sex. Okay, I think that's what I've got to say, and we're getting near to town now, aren't we, sir?
Yeah, I think we're just about at the end of our walk now, so, well, hopefully there's some useful and interesting thoughts in there for everybody. And if you would like to become a patron of our podcasting channel, we would be enormously grateful, you know, being able to pay the rent and eat and stuff like that. So all you need to do, if you go to the top of the page, you'll see a green button that says become a patron. If you click on there, you'll be able to get to another page which will help you to just give us just a tiny little bit of money every month, which would be so marvellous, because yes, starving to death is not too much fun.
We are buskers and scroungers, there's no doubt about that.
But also, we, you know, we like to give what we can give, because, well, that's what we do.
It is. What else is there anyway?
Yeah.